It is our pleasure to be here and visiting with you this week, and I'd like to thank Mr. Weber and the local leadership for allowing us to have this opportunity. I've had a message on my mind for several weeks now, and I got to give it in San Diego last week. I want to share it with you today. It's kind of a pre-Passover message, not directly related to Passover, but as we get along, you'll see, I think, the connections. Are you familiar with the question? The question is this a hill you want to die on? Most of us at one time or another, whether literally or figuratively, found ourselves questioning whether this is something that is worth the consequences that may come from it. The phrase, of course, comes from its roots in military assessment of the value of a given strategic or superior position in the military. Holding a high hill gives you a view and a superior position to the enemy. You can see them coming, and it's much harder to fight uphill than it is looking downhill. Many of us faced a dilemma like this in the mid-1990s when we were challenged on the issues of doctrine and whether or not that was a hill we were willing to die on, to speak, so to speak, and whether we would stand and hold fast with the truth that we had, and knowing very well that that would mean that we would be ousted from our organization at that time. So this afternoon, I want to talk with you about, a hill worth dying on. But first, let's talk about two hills that questionably were not worth dying on. In 1950 to 1953, the Korean War was raging, of course. Politicians at the time preferred to call it a police action, but it was a war, no question about that. And one of the hills and battles that stands out from that particular war was on a hill called Porkchop Hill. And it was actually hill number 255, but known as Porkchop Hill. And Porkchop Hill itself, that hill, this is not a very high-quality picture. There weren't many high-def pictures taken back then. But anyway, it shows you the position that we could look out over the valleys surrounding it, and it was a hill that was fought over quite a bit. It stood 980 feet high, and it became known as Porkchop Hill. Even though that's not a literal translation of the Korean name for the hill, but it sounds quite similar to the Korean phrase, Bokchop-ha. Bok chop high. And so when the the officers and were speaking with the Korean officers and asked them about the hill, they would always begin whatever they were going to go say about it with bok chop ha. And so it turned out to be, the literal translation is, it's complicated. It's complicated. Taking that hill, how are we going to approach that hill? It's complicated. And but the military picked it up and started calling it Porkchop Hill because it sounded somewhat like it. Since early 1952, both of the United States Command and the Chinese had used military operations to gain leverage or to make political statements relevant to the armistice negotiation. We're in our lifetimes of the last 40, 50 years probably more aware of the political nature of war and the reasons that wars are fought, and sometimes why hills are fought over and particular pieces of land. But the Chinese command authorized the April 1953 attack to demonstrate that regardless of how the negotiations were going, if the negotiations weren't favorable to them, they didn't feel like it was necessary to be quit fighting, and if necessary, they would continue to do so. There were two battles for Porkchop Hill, the first in April 1953 and the second in July of that year. In the first battle, the Chinese, in a surprise night attack, drove the United Nations forces, comprised largely of American Army soldiers, from the hill and took control of it. And during a lull in the combat, in May and June of 1953, the U.S. 7th Division rebuilt its defenses on Porkchop Hill. Meanwhile, the final negotiations for an armistice were taking place and being hammered out, and the United Nations anticipating an in-place ceasefire, which I think you probably understand is if the cessation of hostilities, whatever land you hold at that point is what you keep. You get to keep what you're sitting on, what you're occupying. And so that was a big issue here, and thinking that the United Nations forces wanted to be in control of that hill, continued its defensive posture along the main line of resistance. The second battle of Porkchop Hill occurred on July 6th. Once again, the Chinese, using tactics similar to what they had done in the April assault, again attacked Pork Chop Hill. And on both July 9th and 10th, the two sides counterattacked. A large part of the two Chinese divisions were committed to the battle, and ultimately five battalions of the 17th and 32nd Infantry Regiments of the United States were engaged, making nine counterattacks over 4 days. And on the morning of July the 11th, the commander of the U.S. I Corps decided to abandon Pork Chop Hill to the Chinese, and the 7th Division withdrew under fire. The casualties of that particular hill battles for that hill were U.S. casualties, 243 killed, 916 wounded, 9 captured. Chinese casualties, and of course, as we know, the enemy has to be estimated because they don't tell you how many people you've killed. They don't want you to know. We're kind of foolish and spread that information handily. But anyway, it was estimated that about 1,500 dead and 4,000 wounded. Less than 3 weeks after the Second Battle of Pork Chop Hill, the Korean Armistice Agreement was signed by the United Nations Command at Korea, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, and the North Korean People's Army, ending hostilities. The battles for Pork Chop Hill were fought largely as political maneuvers and to gain position in the political negotiations for the armistice. And I asked the question, was Pork Chop Hill a hill worth dying on? And I think, you, as you know, it's a rhetorical question. I think the answer is clear. Later on, 1963 to 1975, when the United States was engaged again in the Vietnam War. And although there were a number of hills the battles were fought over that carried some significance, one of which a buddy of mine from high school was on in the Marine Corps, fought up and down hills, gave them back, fought again, gave them back. Difficult times. But the hill that I want to talk with you about in the second incident is the battle called Hamburger Hill. Official histories of the engagement refer to it as Hill 937 after the elevation displayed on U.S. Army maps. But the American soldiers who had fought there dubbed it as Hamburger Hill, suggesting that those who fought on the hill were chewed up like hamburger, in a joking reference perhaps to the Battle of Pork Chop Hill during the Korean War. The battle was intended to destroy the North Vietnamese Army bases in the remote Sha Valley near the border of Laos. The battle was intended to do that, but after 10 days of bloody assaults and counter-assaults, the U.S. and Vietnamese finally captured the hill. The results and the losses, once again, not as staggering as those on Pork Chop Hill in Korea, were still 72 killed American forces, 372 wounded. North Vietnamese Army losses were estimated at 675 killed and an unknown number wounded. But there was more value and more importance to this hill than perhaps Pork Chop Hill or perhaps many others that were fought in similar situations. The Battle of Hamburger Hill resulted in both American public and military outrage and a reappraisal of U.S. strategy to fight the war, which eventually led to the withdrawal of U.S. troops in 1975. Was the hill worth it? Well, it was captured, and as you can see on the screen, it was heavily fortified. Hamburger Hill was of little strategic value. On June the 5th, U.S. commanders ordered the capture of a frontal assault, only to abandon it soon afterwards. So they wasted good American soldiers, Marines, and soldiers on that hill for political purposes once again. And I ask, is that hill, Hamburger Hill, a hill worth dying on? Neither Pork Chop Hill, nor Hamburger Hill, nor hundreds or perhaps thousands of similar hills and similar wars and military actions were worth dying on. But there is another hill that I want to talk with you about today, a hill worth dying on. Calvary, or Golgotha, a hill that was worth dying on. The word Calvary only appears once in the New Testament, in the Authorized Version. It comes from the Latin Calvaria, which translates the Greek cranion, both of which translate the Aramaic Golgotha or Golgotha, meaning the skull. There are perhaps at least three reasons that I discovered in my research of why people thought that this was a meaning of the skull and where it might be. And because they found skulls there, which I find hard to believe that the Jews would allow bodies to stay even under Roman control, controlled areas, but nevertheless that, or perhaps because it was just a place of execution and people died there, or because in some way it resembled a skull. There were some possible pictures, current pictures of what might be what was Calvary or Golgotha back in the first century. As you can see here, you can kind of see two eye sets in here with a nose coming down there and a mouth sort of in the rocks. If you've got a good imagination, you can probably see a skull there. And that's one of the possibilities. There are others, but no one really knows for certain. However, what is well known is that the Romans used Golgotha for executions, and especially for crucifixion of political and military enemies of Rome. It was located just outside the walls of the city of Jerusalem on a highly visible hill between the road to Bethlehem and the road to Galilee, where it would have the maximum effect on people who passed by, giving clear warning the price for rebellion against Rome. The Galilee area, by the way, was where the rebels that don't get mentioned very much directly in the New Testament, but are nevertheless, I call a missing dimension to the New Testament history, is a group called the Zealots. And they were stationed and hid out in the deserts of Galilee. And so the Romans were always wondering what was going on in Galilee, and problems and troubles came out from Galilee by means of these rebels. And their idea was their primary idea and their driving force behind what they did to foment war with Rome. They knew that they couldn't win, but they knew that they felt at least like they had to precipitate this battle and force God to get to the point where Judah would be just about to be destroyed and then the Messiah would come and save them. And that was their philosophy. And so they attacked Rome and Roman forces and outposts and just everywhere that they could. They, on the high holy days, would sneak into Jerusalem with small daggers in their robes called sicarii, and their purpose would be to assassinate priests because they looked at them as an illegitimate priesthood. I digress a bit, but nevertheless, it's an interesting group to research and to know something about. And part of the reason for where Golgotha, or why Golgotha was chosen as a point of execution for rebels, was so that if these guys were coming in and out of Jerusalem, they would see and know what was going on. In Luke, this is actually a hill or a map. Not a good one, frankly, I admit. I don't have the pointer with me, so I'm going to tell you, as a point up here with shadows, that in this particular area right here is where, at least in this author's or the artist's rendering, is Golgotha. This road is the road that goes to Bethlehem. This is the road over here that goes to Galilee. So when people came through here on major routes to either area, they would go by that hill. It was not a mountain, but a hill of some prominence where it was obvious what would happen there. In Luke 23:33, it says, "When they'd come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left." These two criminals crucified with Jesus, as I alluded to earlier, I believe were not just ordinary criminals or thieves, but were likely aligned with the political and military enemies of Rome, known as the Zealots. Three times the hill is referred to as Golgotha. First in Matthew 27, verses 33 to 35. It says, "And when they had come to a place called Golgotha," that is to say, place of a skull, "they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. And then they crucified him." Mark 15:22-24, "And they brought him to the place Golgotha," which is translated place of a skull. "And then they gave him wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take it. And then they crucified him." John 19:17-18 says, "And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him." We'll get to the monumental event that took place on Golgotha in a few minutes, but first I'd like to discuss with you Jesus' journeys to Jerusalem. And as we go through these, I just wondered, I hadn't really considered, don't know if you have, but I suggested as something to consider as we look at these things, how often Jesus coming into and out of Jerusalem from Galilee or from Bethlehem must have looked up at that hill and known what his future was. He knew that that was the place he was going to die. And I'll show you later on why I believe he knew that. Luke provides the most information about the early years of Jesus' life, of course. But even what he tells is scant, and it leaves us wanting much more. But in Luke 2, verses 39 through 41, he writes, "So when they had performed all the things according to the law of the Lord," that's the speaking of Joseph and Mary, that they had taken the baby Jesus and had him circumcised and presented him, made the offering and so forth that was required of the Jews back then. They had done that. They returned to Galilee to their own city of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. And his parents went to Jerusalem every year to the feast of the Passover. So we know, as we're going to read here later, at least till the age of 12, his parents went to Jerusalem every year for the Feast of Passover. And if they did that, they were likely to have gone at least sometimes during the other two pilgrimage feasts, the Feast of Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles. And we'll read a little bit more about that as we get on through the message. And every year they went and kept the Passover, except, of course, when they were in Egypt. So we don't know how many years exactly. I don't know how many years it was. But you remember that the angel gave them warning and they fled. In Matthew 2, verses 13 through 15, it says, "Now when they," this would be the wise men who came to visit the Christ and the baby Christ, "when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Arise and take the young child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him.'" And you remember that Herod had asked the wise men where they were going, and as he sought out this possible replacement of him as king of Israel. And so he sought to destroy them, and his decree actually went out to kill every male child that was between 1 and 3 years of age, or birth and 3 years of age. And so that's why God spared Jesus and his family and had them go to Egypt. And they were there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt I called my son." In Matthew 2, verses 19 and 21, "Then when Herod was dead," and I apologize for not having that figure off the top of my head how many years that was, but a number of years passed while they were in Egypt, and an angel appeared in a dream to Joseph and saying, "Arise and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." And he arose and he took the young child and his mother and came into the land of Israel. And then we read in Luke about the time when he was 12 and at the feast in Jerusalem. "And when he was 12 years old, they," that would be his family, "went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast." And as I said, this is one of the pilgrimage feasts where the heads of household, at least, and as many as could possibly come, would come to Jerusalem for those three feasts. "And when they had finished the days there, they returned, but Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem." We think that odd, don't we? Nowadays, we think, how could we not know where our child was as we leave and go? And yet the scripture explains that he lingered behind in Jerusalem, and his mom and father, they didn't know it. But supposing that he was somewhere in the company, that is, with other relatives, with aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth, that he was got to be somewhere within the group. And I think if I could draw a little bit of a comparison, at least in the younger days, we would go to the Feast of the Tabernacles, and if our child was off with another group of children and playing, and somebody, one parent or somebody was watching them, well, we just figured that was okay. Everything would be all right. They're with church people. And that's kind of how Joseph and Mary had looked at it, that everything's going to be all right. So they looked around and asked about him, and they didn't find him, and so they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. And now it was, after 3 days, verse 46, that they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. You notice in the sentence before, they were amazed at the questions he was asking. But in verse 47, it says they were astonished at his answers. He knew as much or more than they did. He was making that trip to Jerusalem, even at the age of 12. Maybe, I can't say this for certainty, but traveling that road, looking at that hill, knowing that that's where he would ultimately die. I would have gone some other way. I wouldn't want to see the place that I was going to die and know that it was coming, but he did. And so for the next 18 years, between the ages of 12 and about 30, the scriptures just go silent on Jesus. And at about age 30, his public ministry begins, and so the story begins to flow once again. And the Gospel of John reports that Jesus was in Jerusalem at least on five occasions during the 3.5 years of his public ministry. The first would be shortly after calling his first disciples. That would be Andrew, Peter, Philip, and Nathaniel. And the beginning of his public ministry. And he went to Jerusalem to keep the Passover. This, once again, is the first of the three pilgrimage feasts. And we read about that in John 2, verses 13 through 16. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. And he made a whip of cords, and he drove them out of the temple and charged them and threw their tables over and so forth and said to them who sold the doves, take these things away. Don't make my Father's house a house of merchandise. The next event is recorded in John 5, verse 1. Where it says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Otherwise, this unidentified occasion is thought by some to be Pentecost, the second of the three pilgrimage feasts. And then John 7, verses 1 through 15, tells us about Jesus keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Once again, the third of those pilgrimage feasts. After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him. And now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. And his brothers therefore said to him, depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you're doing. Now they're kind of goading him, trying to get him to reveal himself before his time. And they say to him, for no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. He says, you're doing all these things, but eventually you want to be known openly. So why don't you just go and do them and let everybody know who you are, if that's who you are. You know, I mean, none of his brothers were believers at the time of his death and resurrection. They came along later, but up until that point, it seems that they just did not believe that Jesus was who he and no doubt his mother Mary told them that he was. But his brothers said that this, that if you do these things, show yourself to the world. For even his brothers did not believe in him. Verse 5. And then Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. Yeah, you're always ready to make a name for yourself or pat yourself on the back. But that was not what Jesus was looking for. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go ahead and go up to this feast. I'm not yet going up to the feast, he told them. Not openly, but he went up later. In verse 10 it says, not openly, but as it were in secret. So he went not wanting to reveal himself at that point. He knew the timetable that he and the Father had set. He knew that it was Passover 30 AD when it would be time for him to pay the price that they had decided even before the world began. You go up to this feast. I'm not yet going for the feast, for my time's not yet fully come, he said in verse 8 and verse 9. When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, he also went to the feast openly, not openly, but as it were in secret. And the Jews sought him at the feast, saying, where is he? You know, he always comes to the feast. He's got to be here somewhere. And there was much murmuring among the people concerning him, and some said, he's good, and others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. That would be the Jewish religious leaders, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who were always looking for a reason and a way that they might condemn him and rid themselves of this Messiah, would-be Messiah in their minds. However, no one spoke openly of him. And now, about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and he taught. So he's coming out from the shadows, although not ready to fully begin his ministry, his public ministry. And verse 15 says, and the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? How can he do that? He's never been to one of our colleges, never been to one of our universities, never been to one of our rabbinical schools. We haven't taught him. How does he know the things that he knows? And then the fourth event recorded in John, he goes to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Dedication, or known as the Feast of Lights, and today is most commonly referred to as Hanukkah. But in John 10, verses 22 through 25, now it was at the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was in the winter. These showing, obviously, that this is not one of God's holy days. God's holy days do not fall within the winter, the fall and the spring and the summer, when God's festivals occur. It was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch, and then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, how long do you keep us in doubt? If you're the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. So he had a confrontation, even at this point in his ministry, but premature to the ultimate conflict that he would have with them. The fifth incident to Jerusalem is, of course, the triumphant entry into Jerusalem to keep his last Passover. Verse 1 of John 12 says, in 6 days before Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, 2 miles from Jerusalem, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. Verses 12 and 13 of the same chapter, and the next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. Moving down to verse 23 through 27, but Jesus answered them, saying, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. He knew the time had come, and this would be his last journey and his last visit to Jerusalem as a man. Most assuredly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and it dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. Of course, this is just an analogy here of a seed that is planted that matures, grows, spreads, becomes fruit, becomes a tree, plant, whatever the seed will reproduce. And he's saying the same thing of himself. Unless I die, unless I go into the grave, then I cannot be resurrected and bring life. He who loves his life will lose it, verse 25, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me where I am. There my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. And now my soul is troubled, but what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? Is that what he should say? No, not at all. He said, but for this purpose I came to this hour. In Matthew 20, verses 17 to 19, then Jesus, going to Jerusalem, this is for the same last Passover, told the 12 disciples aside on the road, and he said to them, behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock, to scourge, and to crucify. And the third day he will rise again. Jesus knew every detail of the torture and death that lay before him. And he knew that awful hill where he would die, Golgotha. How many times, as I said earlier, must Jesus have passed that hill on his many trips to Jerusalem and contemplated his future on it? You know of the arrest and the conviction and the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane, that he was illegally tried and convicted by the Sanhedrin that night and brought before the Roman procurator Pilate to receive the death penalty, even though Pilate proclaimed that he found no guilt in Jesus and he ultimately imposed the death penalty Before sending Jesus to Golgotha Hill, he delivered him to be scourged. John 19:1 says, "So then Pilate took him and scourged him." What an understatement. What an understatement. At this point, history tells us more about scourging than the scriptures do. Scourging was known as the Roman half death. They would strip a man to beat him with whips. It was known as the half death, to within an inch of the life before sometimes being the only punishment, and then others to speed up the process of crucifixion and dying on the stake. They were tied to a whipping post, unmercifully beaten with short whips and braided thongs of variable lengths like a cat of nine tails, in which small iron balls or sharp pieces of sheep bone were tied. The back and the legs were pummeled and bruised, the flesh cut and then ripped from the bone. It was a horrible, horrible thing to have happen. In John, here are some examples of scourge whips that I was talking about before. In John 19, verses 2 through 17, the story is related to us. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. And they said to him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they struck him with their hands. And Pilate then went out again and said to them, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." And Jesus said, or came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." And therefore, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him." And the Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. And he went into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" Jesus gave him no answer. And Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and the power to release you?" Jesus humbly answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." And from then on, Pilate sought every way he could to release him. But the Jews continued to press him and cried out, saying, "If you let this man go..." They knew where his weakness was, his loyalty to Rome, and what Rome thought of him. And they said, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." Now they'd gotten to a point where he was sensitive. He knew that he could very well lose his position, lose his power, lose his wealth, maybe even lose his freedom, or even his life, if Caesar thought that he was being kind to someone else who claimed to be a king. Verse 13, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that's called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation day of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." And they cried out, "Away with him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." They had no king but Caesar. And so he delivered them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew, Golgotha. Matthew's account adds in chapter 27, verses 32 and 33, "Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled him to bear his cross." And they had to do this because Jesus was so weakened from the scourging that he couldn't carry the cross member that probably weighed, the estimates, 30 or 40 pounds maybe. Not much for a healthy, in good shape young man to be able to carry. But nevertheless, he could not bear it. And so they took this Simon and compelled him to bear the cross. But keep in mind that as Jesus bore that little piece of wood for the time that he did, that was not his real burden. His real burden was carrying you and me. and our sins to that stake, to that cross, whichever it was, on that hill of Golgotha. And when they had come, verse 33 says, a place called Golgotha, they said to, that is to say, the place of a skull. Now on the way to Golgotha, and along what's commonly known these days as the Via Dolorosa, literally it means the way of suffering. And I'm not about to sit here and go through the 14 steps or whatever it is that other organizations have figured out. This is where Jesus stopped for 3 minutes and did something, and over here he did something else. That's totally speculation, and I care not to do that. But I will say that I think that on this way of suffering, from the Praetorium to Golgotha, indeed, there was not only physical pain and anguish, but mental anguish and distress as well. Through the narrow streets and up the flights of stairs, he struggled. And I said, he wasn't just carrying a cross, he was carrying you and me in the burden of our sins. But Golgotha, my friends, was a hill worth dying on because of who was killed there and what the mission was and what was accomplished. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Crucifixion, Roman style. This is where the hands and the feet were nailed, and we say nails, but it's actually larger spikes were actually driven through the wrist near the hand and the feet and so forth in a manner to cause one to have to push oneself up on his feet in order to get straight enough to breathe. And otherwise, hanging, you can't get air into your lungs. And so the normal reason for death was asphyxiation, the failure to be able to breathe. And if it wasn't going fast enough, this is why the Romans would break the legs of the criminals that were on the stakes so they couldn't lift themselves up, even as painful as it was with the spike in their feet. With their legs broken, it was just impossible to do. There are military objectives of taking a hill, holding strategic and superior position relative to the enemy, and we spoke about that a little earlier. Jesus' spiritual objectives for taking Golgotha were, number one, to fulfill the commitment that he and the Father made to each other before the foundation of the world, that he would die to pay for the sins of mankind. Revelation 13:8 records that for us. And secondly, to reconcile man to God. In the first part of Romans 5, verse 10, it says, "For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through his Son." And indeed, we have been reconciled to God through his Son. John 19, verses 28 through 30. "And after this, Jesus, knowing all things were now accomplished." And as I said before, he knew and ahead what the pain, what the scourging, what the mocking, what the crucifixion would be for him and where it would take place. "Knowing all that all things were now accomplished and that the scriptures might be fulfilled, he said, 'I thirst.' And now a vessel of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled it with a sponge with sour wine and put it on a hyssop and put it to his mouth. And when he had received the sour wine, he said, 'It's finished.' And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit." Mission accomplished. Done what needed to be done. Did it in accordance with the plan that he and the Father had from before our time began. Golgotha the hill was taken. The commitment is fulfilled. And the way is open that man can be reconciled to God. Yes, Jesus took the hill, but that wasn't the end of his accomplishments, because 3 days later, he gained the ultimate victory over death by resurrection. When that stone was rolled away and revealed an empty tomb, everyone that looked was shocked. The stone didn't have to be rolled away to get Jesus out. He probably walked right through it. But the angel rolled the stone away so that Peter and Mary and James and John and the others that came there could look and see that empty tomb where Jesus had lain. The latter part of Romans 5, verse 10 says, "For if when we were enemies, We were reconciled to God through the death of his son. We read that. How much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. We at times will face issues where we have to decide, hopefully only figuratively, if this is a hill worth dying on. Some are, many are not. Most of the hills that I've assessed for myself, in the final analysis, I figured they weren't worth the cost. Some were, and worked out, because the ones that I decided were based on God's word and his promises to us, not because I figured things out or knew what to do. So we've shared this message with you today, and happy to have done so. And I hope that when you think about a hill worth dying on, you'll reflect back on Golgotha. It was a hill worth dying on. And may God add his blessing to the exposition of his word today. Happy Sabbath.